Welcome to the Walt Burdine Show. And we're doing all kinds of things here today. And we're going to let you take the things that you want to know, we hope you find as we go along. And Monroe Dodd is here.
That's right, Walt. We're talking about things past leading up to things present. We're talking today about immigration, coming to America, and becoming citizens. You know, our region, like the rest of our country, is a place of immigrants. Even the original human inhabitants, the Native Americans, came and went. The first European American settlers in our part of the world spoke French with a drab of Spanish here and there. Then came English speakers, many of them from Kentucky and Tennessee, and black people, most of them slaves. And then from Germany and Ireland and Mexico. And throughout Europe and the Americas came more members of more ethnic groups with new and different habits and customs and often languages. Our part of the world absorbed them all, and many of them became citizens. It's still absorbing them, and people are still becoming citizens today. To Kansas alone came Germans, speakers, English, Irish, Swedes, Mexicans, Russians, French. They immigrated to find work and homes in places as near as the West Bottoms and Armordale, and on to Salina and Heston and Lindsborg, and all the way to Garden City and Dodge City in western Kansas. They're still coming. Indians, Ethiopians, Koreans, Somalis, and many of them are becoming proud citizens of our good old USA. The journey to citizenship ends in a ceremony before a federal judge. In Kansas, that ceremony takes place in Wichita or Topeka, and also on the sixth floor of the Dole Federal Courthouse in Kansas City, Kansas. If you go to the sixth floor of that building at 5th Street and State Avenue in KCK, you'll see an exhibit that provides a fascinating overview of the immigrants who have come to Kansas in the century and a half of the state's existence. If you're like me, you'll come away educated and inspired. The exhibit is called Americans by Choice, The Story of Immigration and Citizenship in Kansas. With us today is Jean Swadlinok, a museum consultant who developed the project. She has taught museum studies at KU and UMKC and has worked in various roles at the Kansas City Museum and now runs her own Swadlinok Museum Consulting. Welcome and good morning, Jean.
Good morning, Monroe, and good morning, Walt.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Jean, when many of us think of historical immigration, the first thing to pop into our heads is, oh, Ellis Island, but not Kansas. What inspired this exhibit about immigration to Kansas?
Well, you know, Monroe, I've been working with the federal court in Kansas on history projects for about 17 years. When the Dole Courthouse in KCK was built in 1994, the judges approached me to develop an exhibit on the history of the court. And as they toured me through the facility, I was asking about what else happens here. And when we got to the sixth floor, there are all these long hallways, as you know from your experience yesterday, but they were all blank walls. And they led to a special proceedings courtroom. And as I was told about what happens in that courtroom, monthly naturalization ceremonies where over 90 people who choose to be Americans are sworn in as American citizens by judges of the federal court. I was fascinated by the story, but also quite taken as an exhibit planner and historian with how when you get off the elevator, you have no idea where you are, where to go, or any sense of context for those ceremonies. And I proposed to the court producing an exhibit on the history of immigration and citizenship to fill that space. So as prospective citizens come for their literally on their last steps on their path to citizenship and to take their oath, that they're surrounded now by the history that came before them, the stories of people who came over the past 150 years to Kansas and also made the same choice to become U.S. citizens. And so last year, as the court celebrated its 150th anniversary, they found funding to support the development of that project.
This is the 150th anniversary of federal courts in the state of Kansas.
Yes, and the state's 150th anniversary, too.
Now, you've told me, and I've heard from others, that one of the favorite tasks of a federal judge is the swearing-in ceremony.
Yes, and each of the judges that I have worked with in the federal court in Kansas tells me, and frequently they mention it at the ceremonies, that it's one of their favorite things to do as a federal judge because everyone that comes into their courtroom, when they leave, they're all smiling and happy, unlike many of the other encounters they have in the courtroom.
Now, Jean, migration occurs for different reasons, often different from nationality to nationality. First, there have to be conditions in a home country that have become repugnant and eventually unbearable. And this goes back more than a century in Kansas. What were some of those conditions that people met that caused them to come to America and eventually wind up in Kansas?
There were so many different reasons. And in each country, sometimes many reasons that came together that pushed people from their homelands. And one story that I became familiar with through this exhibit was that of the Swedes who, because of a monetary crisis and devastating poverty in Sweden in the late 1860s, many Swedes came to Kansas and took advantage of the Homestead Act and the opportunity to gain land and property here, which they would never have had that opportunity in their homeland.
We're joined also this morning by Dan Serta. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Dan is on the faculty of the Urban Planning Faculty at the School of Architecture and Urban Design at the University of Kansas. Dan, you grew up in the Armadale district of KCK.
I did.
And you have amassed what I know is an impressive body of research into ethnic communities here and in other cities. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Gene was just touching on something, the Homestead Act, that in the context of the things that drove people from other countries and what might have enticed them to America and these western lands, including Kansas. What are some of the other things that bring people to the United States? What causes people to come from Europe and Asia and Mexico and Argentina?
Absolutely. I think there's two or three factors. I think the one that we probably discount more than we should is the economic attraction of being here. We talk about that implicitly all the time, the opportunity that America provides. But it actually doesn't always necessarily weigh as highly in terms of public policy. If you're coming here solely for economic reasons these days, for example, that unless you're in a sector where there's a defined need for workers, for example, technology, that's not usually by itself adequate. The other one that's obvious is political push. Political strife, basically limitations on liberty and freedom, and again, that's part of the sort of core essence of becoming America, right? The idea of seeking freedom. It goes back to the founding of the country. And so I think between the two of them, the combination of seeking political liberty and freedom, embedded within that religious freedom, the ability to be in a country with a much higher level of tolerance for both ethnic and religious and political minorities, as well as the desire to seek economic opportunity. The other thing, I think that has come out of the research I've done on the Hispanic community in Kansas City, Kansas, very apparent is as much as there are push factors from other countries, there have been very deliberate efforts to draw immigrants here, especially for economic reasons. You look at the ethnic communities of Kansas City, Kansas, for example, Strawberry Hill is very well known for its Slavic history. Slavic immigrants were drawn here by economic opportunity, not just because they recognized there was opportunity here, but because the major industries here actually went to those countries and recruited workers to bring them to the United States. The same thing happened very clearly with the history of the Hispanic community, where railroads in particular recruited track workers from Mexico, many of whom were already working for a lot of those railroads in Mexico proper, and they simply drew them here where there happened to be concentrated operations.
Gene, I years ago watched the movie The Immigrants with Liv Ullmann, and I remember a scene early in it where these people in Sweden, and they were not a happy lot, opened up a brochure, and there in Sweden, Swedish was a was an attraction. Come to Minnesota, I believe. Same sort of thing happened here.
Exactly, and as Daniel said, the railroads early on recruited people and sent emissaries to Europe. Carl Schmitt was one who is credited with bringing up to 60,000 Russian Germans to Kansas, but they went to Germany and to Russia, and apparently he made 34 Atlantic crossings to specifically recruit folks to come to Kansas. This is in the late 1860s. And they particularly targeted hardworking German farmers because they felt they lived a clean life. And when you think about what was happening in western Kansas with cattle being run through the state, there were lots of saloons popping up, and they wanted to bring people that would be hardworking and clean living.
Cowpokes acting badly.
Exactly. Well, they wanted to balance that out. But they actively recruited. And in my research, we found that you know, the railroads in particular were selling Kansas, publishing in multiple different language newspapers, sending emissaries to Europe to recruit people specifically to come here. But also, Kansas passed a special law to provide exemption from military service to especially recruit the Mennonites. And that's what helped to draw Russian-German Mennonites, in addition to Schmidt's efforts.
They had been threatened with being drafted into the Tsar's army
in the old
country.
That's right. After having left Germany 100 years earlier and moved in clusters to Russia and settled there, but they stayed very much apart from the Russian culture. They maintained their German language and their German cultures and food ways and so forth. And so suddenly when the Tsar threatened to remove the exemption from military conscription in Russia, they were looking for other places to go. And Kansas, hearing about that, decided quickly to pass this law in 1874, I believe.
And the C.B. Schmidt had a moniker. They called him the Moses of the Mennonites.
That's right. Because he really single-handedly drew many, many, convinced many people to come here.
Wow. You're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. I'm Walt's co-host, Munro Dodd. Today we're talking about the long history of coming to America and becoming a citizen. Our guests are Gene Swadlinak and Daniel Serta, and our topic centers on an exhibit, Americans by Choice, The Story of Immigration and Citizenship in Kansas. You can see the exhibit at the Dole Federal Courthouse in KCK at 5th Street and State Avenue. It's on the 6th floor where naturalization ceremonies take place. Now, Gene, your exhibit says that from 1865 to 1880, in the decade and a half after the Civil War, Kansas attracted immigrants at a faster pace than anywhere else in the country. What did that? But you've mentioned the railroads. You've mentioned the land. What else was there?
Well, first, it was the railroads, because when the United States wanted the railroad to be completed across the United States, they gave the railroad, our government gave the railroads the rights to land on either side of the tracks that they built. And so the railroad wanted to both bring customers and to gain some profit through the sale of that land. So they worked actively. In addition to that, the Homestead Act was passed, which really was an enticement for people both already in the country to move west, but also for immigrants to come to Kansas to gain fairly inexpensively land, although through much hard work and hardship in many cases. In addition...
And that was 160 acres you could come up with?
Yes. As a homesteader, if you would live on the property for 5 years and make improvements, uh-huh. and if you were either a U.S. citizen or had applied for citizenship, that was a requirement for a homesteader, then you could gain 160 acres after 5 years.
And in the old world, land ownership itself was restricted to a few wealthy and longtime families owners. Your chances of finding land there were often nil in Europe. And now 160 acres is yours if you'll just work it.
Well, and to think about in their home countries, many times because of inheritance traditions, by the time you get to the fifth or sixth son in a family, there might not be any land to get. So coming here and having 160 acres of your own was certainly one of the major draws. But there were other factors, too, that drew people to Kansas during that time period, and some of it was the recruitment of family and friends. I mean, when they came here and got land, got settled, then they would write home, and we've documented many families, and we've all heard stories of families like this, or maybe in our own families, where one brother comes, 2 years later he sends money home, another brother comes, a third brother comes. One family in KCK that I interviewed, four brothers came. Every 2 years, like clockwork, another brother arrived, and then finally one of the sisters was brought over, but they all found work in the meatpacking plants, and then eventually opened a grocery store. But another factor, too, was the coal mine. Coal mines and oil mining in southeast Kansas was part of the draw. So that drew people from Italy and France and some of the other Balkan countries, unlike what was happening with meatpacking, which was one big draw was the meatpacking and industry, particularly in KCK, but also coal mining, which many people don't know about or hear about.
Daniel Serta, we've talked some this morning about the things that lured immigrants to America. But from time to time in its history, America has put up bars to immigration, exclusion and various things, quotas. Talk a little bit about some of those and it's still going on today.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think one of the really interesting things that people aren't aware of, especially with some sort of rancor that we get into in terms of contemporary immigration debates, is that for a lot of its history, the United States had very little in the way of any kind of formal exclusionary bars. You know, the first act of laws excluding entire nationalities from immigrating to the United States didn't happen until the late 19th century, first with the Chinese Exclusion Act. And then, interestingly enough, after World War I, there was a lot of distrust of Eastern Europeans in particular, and there were laws put in place to restrict immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe. That restriction actually opened up opportunities. The recruitment, for example, by the railroads of Mexican workers happened in the midst of European immigration being restricted. There were essentially no bars against recruitment of workers from Mexico. There was no border per se as we know it. There wasn't a fence. There wasn't even really any kind of stations in terms of people crossing that border. And another little bit of our history, which is a little stunning if you think about it in terms of our geography, that people often forget, is that until 1848, the United States was barely half the continent. America became truly a transcontinental nation after the Mexican War in 1848, in which the United States acquired basically everything that we know as the American Southwest. It was all at the time part of Mexico. And, people often forget as well that because that was part of Mexico, there were people there who considered themselves Mexicans who had been there at least back to the time of the Spanish, right, back in the 16th century. And so that the sort of blurring of those boundaries that existed, especially in the Southwest, you find little vestiges of it in places like Kansas City. For example, Westport, Main Street in Westport, which we know today as Westport Road, was the eastern end of the road that went to Santa Fe. Who was in Santa Fe? Well, at the time, back in the 1830s, Santa Fe was part of Mexico. It wasn't part of New Mexico. It wasn't part of a territory. It wasn't part of the United States formally. And so there were Mexican traders, it's documented in Kansas City's own history, that set up shop in Westport that were actively working here. Very small in number, not active immigration, but it was sort of that little link that we had. And those links became stronger over time. Workers were recruited to Kansas City starting roughly about 1905. Both to Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas. And it was in a time where, as I said, there effectively, in terms of policy, there was no bar. In fact, the railroads after World War I sought specific exclusions from the State Department, assurances essentially that they would be allowed legally to immigrate, to import Mexican workers into areas like Kansas City. That being said, that didn't mean that everything was certain and that it was a direct path to citizenship or becoming American. There actually, for the better part of another couple of decades, until really about the end of the Depression, there was a lot of uncertainty in terms of policy on the part of those Mexican workers in terms of whether they'd be allowed to stay. And in fact, there were actually forced repatriations from Kansas City back to Mexico in 1939.
Who's doing the forced repatriations? Immigration authorities?
Well, effectively, yes, but it's a very complicated story because what it boils down to is in the case of the Mexican workers in particular, they were often recruited on a seasonal basis. The track work that they were doing in places like western Kansas or in the Southwest or even in the switching yards, for example, in the Argentine district of Kansas City, Kansas, tended to be work that was a seasonal basis. And so they might come in for 6 months. They might come in for a year. They might be there for 2 years. There was a lot of uncertainty about the length of their stay. And there were periods because of the general ups and downs of the economy that the first major one happened in about 1921, where literally hundreds of these workers who had been in Kansas City in some cases for several years found themselves out of work. And there was pressure from the local chambers of commerce. There was pressure even on the – by that point, Kansas City actually had a Mexican consul in residence to tend to the needs of those Mexican nationals who were here. Actually organized it was actually the Mexican consul in concert with a number of social service agencies and private business interests in Kansas City that organized the first repatriation that sent about 800 or 900 workers from Union Station on a train back to Laredo. And the next one happened, and it was actually part of a larger national pattern toward the end of the tail end of the Depression. But basically it had to do with those seasonal or periodic downturns in employment where people literally ended up destitute. There were those pushes to send folks back. It wasn't anything on the scale of what's been discussed or contemplated mm-hmm. very recently, mm-hmm. in part because the numbers were nowhere near as large. But I think it just underscores the fact that despite the fact that there had been active recruitment for some period of time, and as I said, in some cases, some of those people had been here for many years, there was still an awful lot of uncertainty economically about how long and whether they'd be able to stay. In fact, in the late 30s, there are documented cases from Texas and California where it was actually American citizens in some cases. In other words, people who had been born to Mexican nationals living in the United States, in the United States, who in fact were themselves repatriated.
Gene, another large immigrant group in the 19th century and into the 20th was German speakers into Kansas. You can go a lot of places in Kansas today and find German last names populating the phone book. I know I did in some of my classes at KU. And these people farmed and did all kinds of things and became citizens. But the intimidation sometimes happened against them, too. By the time World War I rolled around, what happened?
Well, this was so sad, in my view. But in 1917, when the Americans declared war on Germany, the Enemy Aliens Act was passed in April of 1917, where all foreign-born, German-born in Kansas, well, actually across the country, were required to register with their local law enforcement agency as an enemy alien. And later in the year, even their wives, even if their wives were born in the U.S., but because they were married to a foreign national, they were required to register as enemy aliens as well. That was rescinded in December of 1918, but many people were required in Kansas, men and women, to register as enemy aliens, and their records are at the National Archives here in Kansas City.
And these might have been people who'd lived here for a number of years.
Oh, one example is a gentleman whose story we feature in the exhibit, Max Wendt, who now eventually lived in Shawnee, but was born in Germany. When he came here, he was 4 years old, came with his family to St. Louis, married a woman from St. Louis, and the two of them came and settled eventually in Shawnee. When they bought a house, because he was foreign-born, he couldn't own property. And so his wife's name is on the deed for the house. But then that was in the 1880s. And then in 1917, he registered as an enemy alien.
You mentioned some other discouraging things in your exhibit toward immigration, one of them being that that women, specifically women who married foreign nationals at one point in our nation's history, lost their citizenship.
From 1907 to 1922, and that was the Expatriation Act, where women who were born in the United States, if they married a foreign-born man, lost their citizenship. And over time, that ended in 1922, and then between 1922 and 1940, different laws were passed to allow women who divorced their foreign-born husband or whose foreign-born husband naturalized, or if he died, she could repatriate and take the oath of allegiance as if she were not born in this country and become a U.S. citizen. It wasn't until 1940 that all women who had married men born in other countries could repatriate regardless of their status, whether their husband was still living or whether they were happily married. And many of those records are also at the National Archives, and we featured one woman. I particularly enjoyed researching this family story because I found the records first, and then I thought, I really would love to have their wedding portrait to show in the exhibit because it's that act that caused her to lose her U.S. citizenship. Mm-hmm. And she applied for repatriation just months after the law was rescinded in 1940. And through some research, we were able to find her grandson living in Seattle. And when I called and introduced myself, explained the project, he told me, oh, well, my Aunt Betty might have family photos, and we were able to get a family portrait of Jamie Lichtenstatter and her husband Siegfried.
Oh, that's wonderful. When we come back, we'll continue our talk with Gene Swadlinak and Daniel Serta about the century-and-a-half-old story of immigration and citizenship in our part of the world. You can join us after the break by calling 816-235-2888 or by emailing us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. And you're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR.
And here we are. Okay, this is Walt Bodine. Glad to see you again. And a chance to look at ourselves and in all the different ways that we can in the mirror of the history. Now, who's on deck today?
Well, on deck is me, Monroe Dodd, Walt's co-host, and we're talking here with Gene Swadlinak and Daniel Serta. The topic is an exhibit at the Dole Federal Courthouse in Kansas City, Kansas, titled Americans by Choice, The Story of Immigration and Citizenship in Kansas. You can join the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or by emailing us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. Are you a recent immigrant? Did your parents or grandparents or great-grandparents immigrate to Kansas? Or are you a recent citizen? Join us with your comments or questions. And, Gene, when we left, we were talking about a family in Seattle that you had turned up that had an important picture to illustrate your exhibit. And tell us their reaction.
Well, when I called this young gentleman, actually, I guess he's not that young, but he's the grandson of a woman who repatriated in 1940. And he told me that he wasn't aware. His father had been a great storyteller and had told many stories of the family's history, but he'd never told the story of his mother becoming both being expatriated and then repatriated. And as we talked more, he realized that because his father would have been a teenager at the time that his mother repatriated, she probably – it wasn't something she really wanted him to know, that she had ever been expatriated. But the family hadn't known that story until we did the exhibit and unearthed their records at the National Archives. I want to say, Monroe, one of the things that we really felt was important with this exhibit was to put names and faces on these stories, to not just talk about facts and figures and the number of people who came from different countries, but to personify that through the personal experiences of people from these different countries who came for all these various reasons. And so that's one of the things that I hope comes through in the exhibit, that these are your fellow Kansans and fellow Americans. Each of the personal stories that's featured is of an individual or their family who were naturalized in Kansas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were many people who were naturalized in the U.S. or came generations before and were naturalized, but we really honed in on those who were naturalized in Kansas because that's the link to the court's history.
There are so many nationalities and ethnic groups, and one we have barely touched on is the Irish. Joining us now is John in Armourdale. Good morning, John.
Hi, good morning.
What's your story?
My Irish immigrant grandparents came over from County Tipperary in 1928 and settled in Armourdale, and my grandfather worked at the Cudahy meatpacking plant.
Mm-hmm.
He was only there 3 weeks, though, until he got a better job at the grain elevator. I grew up in Strawberry Hill with all the Slavic people, and I played for the Croatian soccer team called Dinamo and ate all the food, drank the Šljubovica, that's a plug brandy. And I got a question, too, for my, kind of a statement from my fellow Armadillian there. Explain to people the name Argentine. It has nothing to do with Argentina, right?
No, absolutely. Well, ironically enough, it does in some respects, just in that it's from the same Latin root. The Latin root of the word Argentine is Argentium, which means silver. And the reason we have a place in Kansas City called Argentine, or Argentine, as some people call it, is because there was a silver smelter there that was developed in the 1870s where silver ore being mined in Colorado was shipped to Kansas City to be refined. That refinery operated for about a decade, and then the site sat fallow. Actually, it was a big economic downturn both in the town of Argentine at the time. That eventually led to Argentine becoming part of Kansas City, Kansas, because the economic conditions were so dire. And then later, that site still exists. It was the site of the Kansas City Structural Steel Company, so a major industrial site, really sort of the reason for the existence of a town called Argentine. One little detail I'll add to that, I often tell people that really it's a bit of a misnomer to call the Santa Fe Railroad the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, because the true eastern terminus of the Santa Fe Railroad was Argentine. It was really the Argentine, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad.
John, in Armourdale, what brought your grandparents here from Ireland specifically?
Well, my grandfather had an aunt that lived in Armourdale. Actually had a boarding house down on 7th Street. So, you know, lots of Irish are there. And of course, the Penn Valley area was the place on the Missouri side for the Irish. You know where Brown's Market is at, like Penn Valley Community
sure.
College. Yeah. Also, a lot of people came from Michoacán State, didn't they?
To the Argentine area in terms of Mexican
yeah.
immigration, yeah.
Right. And so the flood of 51 changed a lot of things, you know, obviously, right? The famous flood.
West
Bottom. Yeah. Absolutely. On Friday, July 13th. We all had a good day. It's a great program to hear.
All right, John. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, bye.
Two things to say real quickly. One is that I think the story that John is telling, one of the really important things to remember is that what he's describing is part of what academics would call ethnic succession. Very common phenomenon in American cities to see where one immigrant group arrives. They're sort of the new immigrants. It's typically near the downtown area, near the wharves, near the industrial districts, where there were places to work in the late 19th century, usually with housing within walking distance of those places to work. And then usually within a period of 5 to 7 years, in some cases, those folks would move on and a new ethnic group would come in behind them. So you have in cities like Boston, succession of everything from, you know, sort of the British to the Irish to the Italians, a very similar pattern you see in Kansas City. But we have, I think, probably in some respect, more sprinkling of Eastern European groups than you would expect for the Midwest and both sides of the state line here.
Now, another ethnic group that we haven't spoken much about, but Don in Westport can. Don, good morning.
Good morning. My ancestors on both my mother's side and my father's side were French Canadians, and they settled in Cloud County, and they constituted what we think is the largest French-speaking community in Kansas.
What year was that?
Well, they spread out in the 1880s, mostly 80s and 90s.
And my understanding is that many of the French Canadian who came to Kansas, again, came for farming because of the longer growing season.
Yes. Some of them had been in Illinois, but where they settled, it flooded every year. And so they needed to get away. But before that, they had been in Quebec. And they rented land, and as their families kept growing and there were all these kids coming in, children and grandchildren, that little plot of land that they were renting was just too small to support their growing family, so they had to find other places to move.
So similar to the families who left Europe because there wasn't enough land.
Yeah, yeah. But something I also wanted to talk about was the importance of the Civil War veterans who settled in Kansas. And they, you know, after the war, Civil War veterans got special advantages. And so thousands and thousands of Civil War veterans came to Kansas. There's a little town called Glasgow, Kansas, population 500. And they, the 7th and 8th graders, did an investigation of the Civil War veterans in their cemetery, and they found that there were 87 Civil War veterans buried in that tiny town.
Don Westworth, thank you very much for your call this morning. It's been good talking to you.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Gene in Shawnee. Good morning, Gene.
Good morning. I'm appreciating your program today. My family came from Spain and Mexico to the state of what is today New Mexico. And so I find that issue that Dan mentioned earlier of the borders being blurred over the time and the actual migration of people across those borders over a long period of time. And so when I talk to some of the older members of my family, they talk about, you know, just going back and forth across the border without any incidents with, and in fact, no issues at all. And, you know, I think from a historical, cultural, and even economic, and even a linguistic perspective, I think it's important for us to take into account that migration of people back and forth. And that brings me to the question that I have. Where do you guys think we're headed as far as eventually resolving some of the issues of immigration, especially the negative sentiment towards Mexican immigrants coming into this country to do a lot of the grunt labor that is being done as our economic needs, as Dan mentioned earlier, increase? We're willing to take those workers, but then when the economic need is not there necessarily, we send them back or start passing laws like many states, Alabama and Missouri now. There's a proposed legislation that is very anti-immigrant. Where do your guests think immigration reform might go after the election? I know nothing's going to happen before the elections, but after the elections, what insights might they provide us?
Well, that's a big question and a very difficult question to prognosticate about. But, you know, one thing I think is important to recognize is that uncertainty that I've been describing. You could see it as a consequence of, you know, politicians unable to come to some kind of compromise or people being unwilling to engage in civil discourse with each other. That's often how things are described about it. I think what people miss, and I don't mean to sound cynical in saying this, but there are a lot who there are many who have a vested interest in uncertainty. It allows people to sort of game the system, particularly, you know, employers to have that sort of veil of uncertainty. You know, this is well known and well documented. You know, you hear about immigration rates periodically, but you know, one of the things you discover when those things happen is that in many cases there were workers working under conditions of near indentured servitude. I mean, literally, they were being threatened by employers with expulsion or deportation if they, for example, reported the fact that they were being required to work overtime without being compensated adequately for it. And I think that's one of the really unfortunate things is that there are many who gain by the level of uncertainty that we have in our immigration policy. I agree with you. I don't see anything happening, although I saw very briefly this morning a story saying that the administration is looking at some administrative changes that they can make that might clarify, for example, the status of families that are being separated because of deportation proceedings. But I don't see a wholesale change happening. My own role in this, I see, is in part helping to try to educate people about the fact that we've had these sort of sustained patterns. It is typically in periods of economic distress, like the ones that we're going through right now, where you see the most sort of virulent anti-immigrant sentiments expressed in the United States. Those stories I was mentioning before about those repatriation efforts back during the Depression and before absolutely happened when the economy was down.
Well, and I think we have to remember, too, looking historically, that each of these different ethnic groups that have come, like Daniel mentioned earlier about the Chinese Exclusion Act, we wanted the Chinese here for cheap labor to build the railroads, and they worked in the gold mines in California. And then once that work was completed, they didn't really want the Chinese to be continuing to come in great numbers and started to exclude specific nationalities or regions of the world or set quotas on how many Europeans could come to the United States each year. And so I think the positive note from that is that it took a long period of time, but over time those things did change. It wasn't until the 1940s when the Chinese really were free to emigrate here and become U.S. citizens. Prior to that, they were barred from U.S. citizenship other than those that were born here.
You're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, and today we're talking about a century and a half of immigrants to Kansas who have gone on to become citizens. Our guests are Gene Swedlanok and Dan Serta. Join us with your comments or questions at 816-235-2888 or email us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. And we have a guy who's been waiting patiently here, Larry, in Overland Park. Larry, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a couple comments. One is about the Santa Fe Trail, which I had researched for an author to write a book. And one of the largest imports into this area from Santa Fe was wool. And it was shipped there were some wool mills here that processed textiles. One is up north by, I can't think of the name of it, but that was a big important import into this area. But the other thing I have is that my family migrated here from Prussia to Boehner, Missouri, which was a German community south of Sedalia. And the part of the family stayed there, and others moved into Kansas, and some moved into Colorado. And it was done because of political inscription into the military in Prussia during that time period. And what they did when they migrated was, and as an example, was three brothers and a sister. They each got a section of land. They built a house where the four corners met with a door opening in each section to meet the requirements. The three brothers ranched, and the sister did all the domestic chores that were associated with the ranching operation. And the property's still out there. It's no longer in the family, but it was an interesting way to amass land and keep it in the family.
Where is out there, Larry? Where was that?
That was in South Park, Colorado.
Oh.
And then the other part is my great-grandmother migrated here in a covered wagon from Middle Missouri during the border wars. And she had a house over by the KU Med Center, which was a one-bedroom, no indoor plumbing, no inside water. And she lived until 1951. But a lot of the migration is because of political purposes, which I don't know. I didn't catch the first part of the show, but I think that that's an important aspect of the migration into the Midwest.
Indeed so, Larry. Thank you very much for your call.
Okay.
Kansas has a lot of little communities, Gene Swadlinak, that represent an ethnic, have a rich ethnic minority or majority. In fact, Wilson, Kansas, with their Czechs, Lindsborg with the Swedes. These communities, was this unique to Kansas?
Well, no. I think if you travel around the country and go to different states, you find some similar clusters and patterns of settlement, which really typically happen because of the desire for community. First of all, if people come here and establish themselves in a community, they frequently write home and recruit other family members and friends to tell them they're extolling the virtues of Kansas over the years. And it's much easier for people to settle here if they already know someone, if they speak the same language, if they have the same customs and traditions. And so these clusters grew up around Kansas. Some just kind of happened, like Daniel was talking about Strawberry Hill with both the Mexican community and the Eastern Europeans, the Slavs in Strawberry Hill. You see it in southeast Kansas with the French and Italians who came to work in the coal mines, as well as the communities that you already mentioned. They're really sprinkled all around the state. And then there were other communities that were established specifically as utopian societies and just experimental communities like Silkville, which was established by the French in the early 1880s. And Beersheba that was established
to create silk.
Right, to create silk. They ended up that their most successful business was actually making cheese. Some of those towns don't really exist anymore. They've disappeared off the map. But they were established by immigrant groups who came to Kansas and recruited others to form communities with them.
And you mentioned in your exhibit, Gene, at the Dole Courthouse in KCK, that several ethnic groups formed their own ethnic benefit societies that not only promoted the culture but did things like sell insurance and things.
That's right. And they paid funeral expenses. Huh. But they also had social clubs. They had athletic clubs. The Czechs in particular were very big on physical fitness. And so you see a photograph in the exhibit of the Bohemian Club in Wilson.
Mm-hmm. The so-called. And so this is all over Kansas. Let's go now to Steve in North Kansas City. Steve, good morning.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
Uh-huh.
Part of my family came to Kansas in 1870 as part of the land grant from East Central Illinois, but that lineage I can trace all the way back to about 1619 in Virginia. And apparently they came to Bucyrus as part of that land grant and then moved to Johnson County. And I have a lot of birth and death records from between roughly 1870 and 1900, because I think the federal census was lost to fire in either 1880 or 1890, so there's a hole there. But the folks at Johnson County are just wonderful as far as helping you locate some of that stuff. And apparently we owned about 20 acres out on what is presently Black Bob Road. And then I guess they moved subsequent to that down to the Kansas City side and then some up to Chillicothe. But they were of Scottish and English descent.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for your call.
Right, thank you.
Let's go now to Victoria in Overland Park. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning.
What's your comment or question?
I have a comment. My grandfather, his name was John Joseph Furch. He was German. He was born in March in 1880 in Germany. And he came to this country when he was 6 years old with his family. His father and his mother were cousins. They were born in 1852 and 1856. My grandfather established businesses in Frontenac, Kansas, in southeast Kansas. He owned the first Ford car company there. He and his brother had all of the north side of Frontenac. There was an opera house, a pool hall, and various other things, garage. I have pictures. I have pictures of my great-grandmother and great-grandfather and the family and all the memorabilia. And I just was wondering about the immigration of today with the women and children being born in the U.S., how that compares to when my grandmother, who was born in Pittsburgh, and my grandfather, who was born in Germany, and she would have had to have been registered as an illegal because they were German. So I was just wondering about that, too.
Can anybody answer that hypothetical?
It is hypothetical.
Well, I think the simple answer is that in numbers, you're talking about really different places that
right.
are sort of the drivers of immigration today, and numbers that are orders of magnitude larger
right.
than what would have existed. But I think what all of these stories to me are drawing together is the central importance of immigration in both the settlement and the growth of our region, which, I don't think we necessarily appreciate as much as we should.
Exactly.
You know, another thought regarding the question about your grandmother. Until about 1930, most of the immigrants initially were men. And after 1930, it was more than half of all the immigrants have been women, either following other family members, coming for love or marriage. And we've got a number of stories, personal stories in the exhibit of women who did that. But today, most of the immigrants from Europe and Southeast Asia are still women, while more men come from the Middle East and Africa.
Mm, very interesting.
Interesting. Well, Victoria, thank you very much
thank
for your
you
call.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Citizens are sworn in three different places in Kansas today, Wichita, Kansas City, and Topeka. There's a special court room at the sixth floor near your exhibit, Gene, in KCK, where these ceremonies take place. How often do they take place again, and how many people are involved each time?
Well, in Kansas City, Kansas, the ceremonies are held monthly. I know that in the last few months they've actually had two ceremonies a month in KCK because of the demand. So many people applying for citizenship and going through the process. And ceremonies are also held in Topeka and Wichita regularly. I think in Wichita it's quarterly, and it's actually held at the Century 2 Center because of the size of the group that are naturalized there. This past year, though, ceremonies were also held in Leavenworth, Fort Scott, Salina, Lawrence, Dodge City, as well as Wichita, Topeka, and Kansas, in a celebration of the court's 150th anniversary and the fact that the court is authorized to preside in all of those cities. And I think there are some plans in the future that some of those locations will continue to host naturalization ceremonies.
So a lot of newly minted Americans. Let's go quickly to Linda. Good morning, Linda, in Prairie Village.
Hi. Yes, I was calling because a gentleman, Don, I believe his name was, talked about his ancestors that were French-Canadian, and I have, my father's name was Dolphus Ambroise, which is very French, and they're from Cloud County also, and my grandfather during the Great Depression, his name was spelled L-A, capital B-O-N-T-E, and when he went to work for the railroad in Topeka, he changed it to L-A, capital B-O-U-N-T-Y. So he might be a relative of mine that lives around here that I'm not aware of. So it was just kind of interesting to hear that.
Well, it's something we don't often do here on the Walt Boudin Show is put families together. But good luck with getting that together, Linda.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call. One last thing, Gene. Those of us lucky enough to have been born in the U.S. haven't had to do nearly as much work as these new citizens. Briefly, what do they have to accomplish to become citizens?
Well, first they file their application. There is a whole series of items that they must meet certain requirements, and those are all listed on the USCIS website at uscis.gov, but they're also listed in the exhibit. And then once their application is approved, they meet with an examiner and must pass a test that includes questions on U.S. history and civics. And that test, a sample test, is in the exhibit that you can take on a touch screen and see how well you could do on a naturalization test.
Sounds rigorous. That's all the time we have for today's show. Our guest has been Gene Svedlanak, who has overseen a new exhibit called Americans by Choice, The Story of Immigration and Citizenship in Kansas. You can see this overview of immigration to our part of the world on the sixth floor of the Dole Federal Courthouse at State Avenue and Fifth Street in downtown KCK. It's open from 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. Also with us has been Dan Serta of the Urban Design Faculty at KU, the School of Architecture and Urban Design. Gene and Dan, thank you very both for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information on our guests and upcoming shows, visit our website, kcur.org/Walt Boudin. Click on the Walt Boudin Show. Our show is produced today by Tamika Weatherspoon, and our announcer is Kim Noble. I'm Monroe Dodd. We'll be back in 3 weeks for another history show. And, Walt, enjoy your day.
You.